This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. So we're back from a very busy Mental Health Awareness Week, which was under the theme of kindness. And I feel like I benefited from that because many other podcasters kindly had me on their show and I got to do loads of collaboration. And that includes a surprise one, which was the No Really I'm Fine podcast. So as of recording last week, that hadn't even been recorded yet. So they turned that around really quickly, hence why I talked about a surprise. But that is now out, so I'll include a link in the episode description if you want to hear me talk about Mental Health Awareness Week. We also touch on the strangeness of being a podcaster right now. It's a far chattier interview than I'm used to, but one I really enjoyed. And we're already planning how to collaborate more, so go follow them and you can look out for more from us with them in the future.
Brilliant. I was going to ask you actually, Bobby, how you found it. You just said you really enjoyed it. It
does. Yes, absolutely. They're so lovely. And so hopefully we get to work together way more. And I've got an open invitation to return when they get back to their recording studio and their usual setup. So we'll have to have a think about what topic to go talk on.
Brilliant.
Yeah, really pleased with how that went. And of course, we're delighted with Hope from the Frontline, our special episode for Mental Health Awareness Week. So if you haven't listened to that already, I'd really encourage you to. It's six key workers talking about their experience during the pandemic, but how they're finding hope and committing to caring for the most vulnerable so that we can all stay as safe as possible. So it's a really uplifting episode. And we were just saying before recording how proud of it we are.
Yeah, it was brilliant. I'm really, really pleased with it. It's so good. Love that we gave voice to all of those different people. It was quite emotional, actually, in a really nice way. I loved it.
Yeah, good. Loads of great people, including friends of both of ours as well.
That was funny. My friend's like a mini celebrity on our WhatsApp world. It's hilarious.
So
I'm just bothered about the fact that she sounds so Brummy.
But I love it. You know me, I love accents. So I don't know how much the listeners notice this, but we get a lot of different accents on the show. It's the way it works out and the way we try and very broadly source guests. But it's also personally for me something that makes me very happy because I find accents fascinating and I like to present as broad a perspective on mental health as we can. So no, for me, I love a good Brummy accent on the show. Remind people where we're recording from. Even
absolutely.
If it's over Skype right now. That hadn't even occurred to me. It's the first time we've ever had two Brummies interviewed on the same episode, and yet we couldn't see either of them in person. Strange. What a strange time. And it's been a very strange weekend. I feel like possibly the strangest bank holiday weekend I've ever known.
Do you?
Yeah, there's so much going on in the news. Of course, Dominic Cummings is the main news story and has been for a few days. And it's very strange because usually if you're a political advisor, you stay very much behind the scenes, you know, so that you can push forward the person you're working for and very much encourage them to take your advice and run with it as opposed to you having your own platform. You know, that could be seen potentially as a bit of a distraction. And usually when controversy does surround advisors, they quit very quickly. So, for example, when Theresa May had her general election and didn't get the majority that she wanted, her two lead advisors quit within days. So it's odd when normally these are the first people to be cast out.
Mm-hmm. But we're not in normal times, are we?
No, it is a very strange time. And of course, as you know, there is sympathy for his decision making and him talking about, you know, looking after his child. But I think overwhelmingly, people feel he should quit. That appears to be the majority consensus. And I very much agree with that. There have been plenty of political leaders, including the chief medical officer in Scotland, who have quit for far less yes, she visited her second home, for example, during lockdown and went against the official advice, but she didn't have symptoms and she wasn't disobeying the stay-at-home message to the same extent. Whereas it's, well, at least I thought it was very clear. It seems less clear now. The guidance appeared to be, if you have symptoms, you stay at home for 7 days. That's that. Like, that is one of the overarching rules above everything else. And as much as I'm trying to have sympathy for the situation, a local group that was supporting those that needed to self-isolate dropped a leaflet into his letterbox on the 19th of March before this journey happened, volunteering their services of support. So I don't really believe that there were no childcare options.
I mean, I'm being quiet, aren't I?
No, go on. I want to hear it.
Well, no, I don't really have much. I haven't really spent much time thinking about it, really. I've had conversations with people when I've had chance to have my regular phone calls and Zoom chats with friends and family. And I've probably spoke about that for like, 3 seconds. It's just not on my main agenda. I just think there's much more, it just gives me more kind of disappointment really in our media, because I just think it's the amount of attention he's got, you're right. And I just don't think these things need to be spoken about so widely, dramatically for so long. It's just giving everybody a chance to kind of get stuck in, regardless of whether it's right or wrong.
I get what you mean. I think a lot of people have been saying the same as well, that there has been so much focus on one person's behaviour during the lockdown. But I think that you could argue, yes, the media have been so focused on it and it has been such a big headline, given that this is, yes, one family's decisions. However, on the flip side, one way for this story to have gone away a lot quicker would be for him to have resigned.
Yeah, perhaps. I do understand that when it's your job to advise the government and we're all trying to take lead from that, then there's a line then that you can't cross. It's just your job. It's like,
right,
you're a big, know what I mean, pop star or athlete or whatever, you are in a role, modeling position, so unfortunately you might not like that, but that comes with your job, so you have, that's something you have to do. So that's my big thing with it. Second thing though that gets me from a more humanistic point of view, and I guess a mental health point of view, is that we are villainizing somebody, and I just don't like to see people's faces in the media with big headlines against them and really kind of nasty and mean things said about them. I just feel it goes too far, and with the world that we're in, that concerns me. I try not to buy into that, because at the end of the day, the guy's a human being, isn't he? It doesn't sit comfortably with me.
I see what you mean, and that's something that's very prevalent nowadays. The public have a voice in these matters more than ever before. Something will be trending on Twitter, whether or not someone's in public favour, and that's not just a political thing. But it does make me think when, like you mentioned, pop stars are held to such a high standard, to an extent that many of them don't even talk about politics at all, because they know how career-defining that could be. For someone actually in politics, it seems even more appropriate that we get an opinion. For me, my main concern is this undermining the message. And in fact, particularly some of the comments that have been made around it, I found quite irresponsible. So, for example, I'll play a clip here of Boris Johnson, where he addressed it in one of the daily briefings.
I think he followed the instincts of every father and every parent, and I do not mark him down for that. I believe that in every respect, he has acted responsibly and legally and with integrity.
And seemed to imply that either all parents were doing this or all parents should be, to be a good parent. And that's, that's very much not true. We know that the majority of parents are following the rules and are staying at home if they've got symptoms. And making some really, really tough decisions to protect the health of everyone. So it has been really weird to have a whole weekend focused on someone that I think the majority of us had no idea who he was previously. And it does seem to be against the messages. So in interest of what you've said, we won't give any more airtime to that particularly. But my final thing I'd say is that I do worry that if this drags on much longer, it will really damage the messaging that only in our last episode like this, we talked about being increasingly confusing on what the guidance and what the lockdown measures are now. And I worry that if he doesn't resign soon, or if this story doesn't go away, then it won't be long until someone else quits.
Yes, Bobby, I agree. And I think that's a great point kind of to end on, in the responsibility or the irresponsibility of comments made and behaviour while we're all trying to navigate through what is a really vague message now. You know, right at the beginning, we kind of knew the message. This last couple of weeks, it's all been a little bit vague and we're not quite sure. So to have somebody in that position then also seemingly feel like they don't know what the message is and you're the person that's supposedly come up with the message, with you and your colleagues, that is very worrying. And that's the point, that's the problem. You're absolutely right, it's fueling people in all different types of ways, and that's the worrying thing.
Yeah, 100%. And so we'll move on to something that, for better or for worse, does feel a bit clearer. And that is, the schools are going to be starting to go back from the 1st of June. So as our honorary parent on the show, what's the communication been like from the school of your girls?
They've done the best they can in terms of, we all got a letter, we've known, obviously Boris has mentioned this in terms of giving schools notice and parents notice. So what, 4 weeks, maybe a month, it started to get talked about a little bit. We got a letter, so we're in half term now. And for those who aren't parents, who have a clue, we're just
I have no idea. I have that pretty much every school holiday. I'm like just shopping as I normally would, and I'm like, where are all these kids from? After like work it out in my head, oh, it's probably a holiday.
Yeah, even Anthony said to me today, oh, I know it's bank holiday, but he's like, oh, we've got to think when you're working, or when he's working, the schedule for the kids this week. I was like, well, we don't need to be so tight. It's half term. He's like, oh my God, oh yeah. So we're all kind of trying to stick a bit to that. It gives us all a break, really, from homeschooling and things.
Yeah, it's such a great example, though, of routine. You know, we've talked about how important that is for mental health. And it's gone from losing track of hours and days of the week to now we hardly know what month it is or whether it's a holiday or not. You know, I was saying only to Kat yesterday that it still kind of feels like March, like our whole world's just been on pause.
Yeah, that's so true.
Anyway, sorry, so, tell me about the letter.
Yeah, so that's where we're at. But school sent us a letter. And I just think like, oh, you know, I'm one of those parents that 100% support school and the teachers basically within our school. I just feel for them, like they're trying their best. But so their letter said quite clearly, do you want a space for your child? And we've got three options. Yes, full time. Yes, part-time, yes, 1 week on and 1 week off, which seemed a bit, I didn't quite know kind of what the point of that bit was, 1 week on, 1 week off. It seemed neither.
Maybe they alternate for social distancing, I'm not sure.
Yeah, but it wouldn't really help so much with a routine, especially with people working or not. That would be quite difficult. Or obviously no. And we had to just give the answer. We had to just fill in the form by noon tomorrow. This was 2 weeks ago. So 24 hours to fill out the form and to give your answer and told that this would be your only opportunity to give an answer. That was pretty strange. But my year one child is still apparently going back next Monday. That's a week today. And we've got all these guidelines of now there's no full time. The three options that we were given before have now been retracted. And now it's my child will only go in either Monday or Tuesday or Thursday and Friday. And Wednesday will be a cleaning day. And the classes will rotate, and there were lots of things that we've had in a really detailed risk assessment about cleanliness, about corridors being used. There won't be the hall, won't be in use, the school office won't be open. And in a way, I do have concerns around whether or not my child is going back, but the mental health of the children, actually, once they go back, to see such dramatic changes in school. I know they'll cope. Kids are resilient. We all have shown that throughout all of this, but you know, for my year one child who's just turned six to go back and there'll be no hall where she loves having lunch, where she loves having assembly. There'll be a partitioned area in the playground. She won't be able to cross her line. So it's now interesting as when you get all the information back of how they're going to maintain safety, which you want as a parent. I've then suddenly started thinking, wow, how is Rhea going to react then to being in a school that won't feel like school at all? that's another adjustment for her, you know, and being so young.
Yeah. And does that weigh on your family mental health more generally, the fact that your youngest is the first person going back out into the world in this way?
Absolutely, to the point where she may not be. You know, my other half is adamant she won't go back, and I've been unsure. But the fact that it's Monday already and I could be putting her in her uniform next Monday, all of a sudden feels a little bit anxiety-inducing. I don't quite think I'm ready. You know, 3 weeks ago I thought, yeah, if that works, maybe we could do a little part-time. She could go back. Ria would love going back to school. All of a sudden now it's very close and I'm a little bit like, I don't think so. And he's saying no. And we've got another child who will be at home. Like, what's the point? Why should one go and the other one not go?
It is strange.
It doesn't make sense.
And I'm really delighted that we've got a special guest for the episode today who's going to share a little bit more about another perspective on the schools going back from the point of view of an educator. And that's something that we talk about a little bit in the interview with Natasha, that a lot of the motivation seems to be the economy. But then even if you just had one child and they were going back, if like Ria, they're going back just for 2 days a week, that's not really going to make childcare any easier for you.
No.
So it's a strange one. I mean, it slightly links back to what we were talking about Dominic Cummings, because of course, for key workers, the majority of schools have stayed open to look after their children. And so there's definitely an argument that he is senior enough in the government that he could be classed as a key worker. And therefore, his child could have gone to school to protect them from.
Yeah, interesting.
The parents having symptoms and concerns over childcare.
That's very interesting, yeah.
And as you say,
the key worker children in the school, just for reference, are still maintained in their key worker bubble. So all the children in our school who have been going in as key worker children, imagine we're labelling them, you know, bless them, the key worker kids. Really, they're like this little group of kids that have been shoveled into school all the time and nobody else is there, but they'll have adapted, they'll be fine. It's our problem with it, you know.
Well, actually they're
quite uncomfortably, so it's not very nice, is it?
But maybe they are finding it better because they're still in the routine of school, so it's difficult to know. Anyway, for now we should get into our stats that we look at every week. So I'm going to load those up among my hundreds of tabs. So first, the number of people who have had a confirmed COVID-19 case and recovered from it is now 2,388,034 as of recording on Monday. So that is an increase of over 800,000 since we mentioned that 2 weeks ago. And also the proportion of people who have a serious or critical case of COVID-19 at the moment globally has remained low at 2%. So it's nice to see that even with us taking a week off from this kind of coverage so we could do our special episode, even with all that's happening, there's still some positive sides to the statistics. And then one thing that I was kind of reluctant to say in the past, but I do feel like it's an appropriate prediction of mine, is that I do believe at this stage we are going to see cases start to rise again. Whether or not we have a second peak, of course, I really hope not. You know, this is why we're taking the guidance so seriously. And we really hope that the measures are still respected. Because from what I've seen and from how quickly some of these measures are now going to be lifted, with that in mind, I can see cases starting to rise again this week, or if not next month. And of course, we could argue that that's sort of always going to happen, that lockdown measures need to be fine-tuned as we go out of them. But I think we will see some increase, and I just hope that that's noted and appreciated fast enough that it can be brought back down. Because of course, we know that there's a delay in people's symptoms becoming usually bad enough that they notice them and get the diagnosis. So there's always this kind of time delay. So that's why it's so important that if there is a rise again, if that prediction does come true, which of course we hope it doesn't, that the action is taken very quickly.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you'd feel comfortable that the NHS aren't absolutely I mean, do I dare to say that they're not completely dead on their feet and wiped out? Because I'm sure there's plenty of medics out there that feel that way. But we've got opportunity for beds. We're in control, it seems, at the moment. So if it does start to rise, hopefully not anywhere near how it was. But if it does, I feel like we've got some capability to manage it. However, that's not the point. The point is that there are people out there that really are just saying two fingers up to any kind of rules or any kind of, you know, lockdown now, that they've had enough and they're just doing whatever they want. I've seen so many videos, Bobby, of like music kind of get-togethers, like late night, people out on parks. You know, the weather in this country doesn't help because it's such a bloody novelty that everybody like just wants that like whole festival out barbecuing kind of vibe, you know, and you live in a hot country, the sun doesn't mean that you'll go out, you know, right. It's because we're here. There's been like evening things up on big parks where people have gatherings basically, drinking, music, stuff that have been throughout the whole time when there's been hot days on beaches and
right. And I get it, you know, it does feel like we're having our summer right now, you know, and that actually the summer may even be over from a weather perspective very soon. So I understand that temptation, but you know, we have to prioritise the health of the nation and the world right now. That should be the number one uniting focus. And so I hope that continues, even if the lockdown continues to be eased with this speed.
Yeah, and I think, Bobby, I wanted to just make a point there that, again, really does align itself to how we feel and our mental health and with trust and paranoia and things like that, because I don't know what other children at school, what their parents are doing. You know, that's the point. You know, school probably can in themselves protect my children, but not from other children and what their families are doing. I don't know. I can trust I can visit my mum, stand on her doorstep. I know my mum hasn't been anywhere in 9 weeks. She hasn't even been in a supermarket. She hasn't seen anybody. She's had no symptoms. And I feel quite comfortable that I could go for a walk on the park with her and keep our distance, but pretty safe even if I didn't, which I will. I can't vouch for everybody else. And that's the problem, I think, with, you know, with this, why your prediction is probably going to come very, very true.
And why we need to protect ourselves in order to protect everyone else. That's the key. Yeah. We've all got to stay safe, if not for us and for our neighbour. Yeah.
Will you wear a mask, Bobby? Would you wear a mask?
I would definitely wear a mask. It's interesting, actually linking to a previous prediction, because we talked about masks before. And I think I said something along the lines of they may eventually have to encourage mask wearing because it'll just get to the point where we need to throw another precaution at this as opposed to the science necessarily changing. You know, and that seems to be very much the case that we are now being encouraged to wear masks. But there hasn't been a no, the science has changed or no, we've reinterpreted the science. It's just a let's be extra safe about this.
Mm.
So, it'll be interesting. And then the final thing, as always, to round up with our potential positive, although as time gets on, it is more difficult to find as many of these because, of course, we don't want to be repeating them. One that I've felt very grateful for this week is a renewed focus on journalism, that we were very much going downhill. You know, there's obviously all the concerns around fake news, the rapidly declining sales of newspapers, which I feel is partly contributing to attention grabbing as opposed to accurate headlines at times. And so I really hope that with more focus on journalism and more public demand for really good journalism and answers in a time like this, clear answers, that we will see some improvements and hopefully opportunity for journalists that are doing things right to come to the forefront. So, for example, Piers Morgan is being really celebrated right now because he's really pushing for answers and he's giving some very tough interviews to government officials. And I think people appreciate that right now, particularly when this is someone who historically has said some very inappropriate things about mental health. Even one of our own guests, Lucy Nichols, is very against him usually for that reason and has talked about that on the show. So, you know, I hope that continues. I hope that this renewed focus on journalism, us all potentially consuming more news than usual, gives a bit of a positive boost to that industry and one that encourages high quality truth analysis.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Yeah, let's hope we see more positive, accurate, true journalism and news stories coming from this, and with podcasts and so much more, and journalism having such a wide scope now, it's great to see that there's more and more of that happening. So we're not going to the same source for the same information all the time. There's much more discussion around topics through things like amazing podcasts like Mental, where we get our information and news from. So yeah, it's a great point.
Good, thank you. So with that all said, we'll introduce our guest, Natasha Devon, MBE. She's an incredible mental health campaigner, writer of, I've honestly lost count of the books, but the one that is my favourite so far is, she did an A to Z guide on mental health, which is really good for a brief summary of a really broad range of topics, including many conditions. She currently runs a campaign to get one mental health first aider into every workplace in the UK, which we thoroughly support. And so I'm so delighted to get a chance to speak to her and hear about her perspective as someone that also teaches and goes into schools and delivers talk on mental health and stigma, body confidence, a whole range of topics. It's funny, even as I say it, I'm thinking about, oh, she sounds like how I live my life. Like, how do you describe a person that does so many things? But yeah, hopefully you can all see how relevant she is as a voice on this topic. So we'll get into this special interview with Natasha Devon in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
I'm Natasha Devon, and lockdown has been, I think, quite a positive experience for me. Obviously, I'm not glad that it happened. And when I'm looking at the wider state of the world, I am incredibly concerned with everything that's happening health-wise and politically and some of the dreadful situations that other people are in. Having said that, I think I've rolled a perfect six in the potential dice of lockdown, insofar as I do have a small patch of garden, so I wasn't confined to an indoor space. I have a partner who I get on with incredibly well. I don't have any children to homeschool. And whilst, of course, I did take a financial hit and a lot of my work, which I would normally do traveling around schools and colleges, was cancelled, I had enough work to keep me ticking over so that everything just didn't abruptly stop. I was able to take some of my work online and also pursue other projects that had kind of been on the back burner because I was so busy in schools. And I think for me, it's taught me a little bit about what my priorities are and what I'm genuinely passionate about. It's been an opportunity to do a little bit of introspection. So yeah, I feel there's been some personal growth during this time.
Good. No, I totally agree. I've had a lot of that experience of being alone with your thoughts, and that can be a positive thing if you're in the right mental space, and I'm lucky to be coping relatively well with it so far. And with your work teaching and usually being in schools for much of your time, I'm interested to know how you feel about this element of lockdown being lifted, that schools will start to go back from the 1st of June.
Well, I'm not going to lie, it is weird trying to interact with a classroom via tech. And I know a lot of teachers will relate to this. One of the skills that you develop is reading a room. And that's just from body language. You can tell from whether the class is leaning in and just the general vibe of the room, whether what you're saying is landing, whether it's being understood, whether you're connecting. And you get used to sort of adjusting your subject matter in your head. You go, I need to explain that a little bit more, or I need to move on, or whatever it is. And that's not something that you can do digitally. You just have to deliver the content and hope for the best. But having said that, it is possible. And I think my concern with schools opening on the 1st of June is, first of all, it seems to be based on the idea that children are asymptomatic, but the studies are contradictory when it comes to whether or not children can pass on the illness. So they may not actually show symptoms themselves, but that doesn't mean that they may not be able to pass it on to the adults around them. So I think firstly, what about teachers? Also, what about parents who are going to be obviously picking up and dropping off? It seems to me that this is a very risky move and that it's probably more about childcare and getting parents back into work and kickstarting the economy again than it is about any concern for education, because particularly in years they are advocating that children go back, it's been proven in numerous studies that they can take a break and they'll catch up and that they can learn through play and just living their lives. And they're not going to suffer academically too much from missing out on 6 months of school.
Right. Yeah, no, that's really interesting to hear. And I didn't know as much about the research behind how these different age groups cope, but I agree that it does seem more of an economic rather than education focus, particularly when you think about the ages that are going back. That yes, older kids can be potentially more at risk of contracting a more severe form of the virus. But I think it would be easier at the same time for us to justify exam age children going back. Whereas that these very young kids, you wonder if as much of the motivation is there. It's been a long time since I was at school, but I don't really think I learnt very much in year one, for example. Certainly not much that I can remember learning.
The whole thing has been really interesting from my perspective to witness, because teaching is slightly unusual insofar as the vast majority of teachers are a member of a teaching union of some description. And the most popular teaching union is the NEU, the National Education Union. And I know unions have a reputation for being kind of lobbying organizations and being very political, but certainly I've not seen that. What I've seen is that the NEU is really good at representing the interests of its membership, and it's always doing surveys and studies and trying to ascertain what its membership wants. And that membership is very broad across the spectrum of teachers. It's not just, super lefty teachers. And yet, there has been a lot of rhetoric in the press which has portrayed unions as having an agenda. And as far as I can see, their only agenda is doing what's right for their membership. And this was something that I came up against again and again when I was trying to work with the Department of Education as the government's mental health champion. I listened to the unions because, for me, what the unions were saying made absolute sense and really chimed with what I was seeing on the ground in schools. And yet, every time I did, I was always accused of being political and therefore not neutral, and therefore that opinion was automatically dismissed, no matter how common sense it was. So it's great that the BMA have stepped in and said, actually, we support what the unions are saying. We cannot guarantee teacher safety.
Right. And it's always a very strange thing for me to witness, complaining about other people making things political.
Oh, it drives me nuts, if you'll excuse the expression. I actually spoke about this on my podcast a few weeks ago. The thing is, things are political. Health is political. Education is political.
Right. We have an education secretary. Of course, it's political.
Exactly. Our entire existence is inextricably linked with politics. And so when you have conversations with people and you are critical of government policy and you're told to stop being political, what that other person is actually saying is just, they're just trying to shut you up.
Exactly. It's don't criticize us is what it sounds like to me. And one thing that I've found has been sort of lost in a lot of the conversation is that the schools have remained open in part for children of key workers. So as much as there can be a debate about whether or not young kids can be carriers or can be carriers frequently, because I think we understand they can be carriers to some extent, what hasn't been mentioned is that the kids that have remained in school are more likely to be in contact with the virus because they're kids of key workers. And therefore, we're sending our children into a kind of almost a frontline by proxy situation. Mm.
And when you read the government's plans for reopening schools, I mean, I must have read them about 10 times and I can't make sense of them. So they're talking about halving class sizes that will involve children going to a school that perhaps isn't the school that they attended before. But if you look at a city like London, where I live, every single school is oversubscribed. So you've got this, say there's 30 children in a class, you've got this 15 child overspill that just carries on indefinitely. And you just end up with hundreds of children who are just displaced somewhere. So that then you do end up with this massive inequality in the experiences of children. And that's exactly what, I know that the Children's Commissioner for England and Wales was saying that she was worried about certain children having an academic disadvantage because they maybe didn't have a laptop at home or couldn't access digital lessons, or their parents are working and aren't able to homeschool them. But as far as I can see, this strategy of the government potentially makes that even worse.
It's interesting that you mention that, because something I've wondered about is, would it not make more sense that the children that aren't getting the support as much at home, or maybe don't have access to educational necessities there, they're the ones that go back to school first? So instead it's related to need as opposed to them just choosing years, something that's, I don't feel, has ever been fully explained why these particular age groups.
No, it hasn't been explained, because I don't really think there is any rationale to explain, to be honest. A lot of it just seems to have been pulled out of the sky. One of the things it says is, if a child needs to go to the toilet, it has to be ensured that they don't pass a child from another class in the communal areas of the school. And there are a lot of primary schools in particular that are saying that there's literally not enough room on site to ensure that that will happen. And also, how are we going to police that? Is the teacher going to have to come out with that child and take them to the toilet? Then who's supervising the other 14? And what if they pass another member of staff in the hallway? It's just so badly thought through. And I can't help but feel that the insistence they go back on June the 1st is A, financially motivated, but B, was used in the briefing by Boris yesterday as we record to distract from the Dominic Cummings debacle.
I think you're right. I had exactly the same thought, that it seemed convenient that on a Sunday of all days, they announced another wave of years going back. So years 10 and 12, perhaps more understandably, given that they're examination years, they're very key. But I did wonder when that decision was made. Surely it wasn't made on a Sunday. So was that pulled out for another reason that day? If it was made sooner, then why was more notice not given? Because there are already concerns about, can enough schools open safely by the 1st of June, let alone open further?
It's such a strange time, because all the political structures that we have come to perhaps take for granted have been completely overridden, and we're moving closer and closer to a dictatorship style model. Because, you know, I didn't vote for Boris Johnson. I voted for my local representative to represent my interests. And yet, because Parliament is effectively closed and everything's being done remotely, local MPs are not being consulted to the extent that they were. And even members of the Conservative cabinet say that they feel that they have been kind of shut out of the decision-making process. So everybody is just being taken completely aback by these seemingly random announcements that keep happening in these daily briefings that I have started to watch through splayed fingers, actually. Can't look directly at it.
Yeah, no, understandably so. I started off watching the news a lot more, and I found it quite reassuring in a way to see packages of support being announced and to hear about measures being introduced. And, you know, that helped me feel that action was being taken. And over time, it's become more and more complicated and confusing. And it's actually exposed a lot of strange ways in which the UK functions anyway. So, for example, Boris Johnson will regularly address the nation, and that's televised across the UK. But the things that he announces are increasingly not relevant for the devolved nations. You know, and then you have Nicola Sturgeon and others then have to speak up and say, just a quick reminder, what Boris has just mentioned doesn't apply in Scotland.
Yeah, I love Nicola Sturgeon. I love how every time Boris takes to the airwaves to give some guidance, she just immediately is on Twitter going, everyone in Scotland, ignore him. We're not doing that.
I know.
It is so odd.
It would be almost sitcom level if it wasn't so horrific what we're dealing with.
Well, that's the thing. It is becoming slightly Orwellian, the times in which we live. And it would be incredibly interesting if we weren't living in it. There's actually an old Yiddish curse, which is, may you live in interesting times. You know, because fingers crossed, touching wood, you know, all the other superstitious things. In 10 years' time, if a child says to me, 2020, what was that all about? And things are better and I'm able to look back on it, you know, from a position of nostalgia almost, I will love disseminating it and, you know, talking about everything that happened in the years building up and how odd it all was. But when you're actually living it, it's terrifying because everything that you thought you knew about how the world works no longer applies.
Right. I would add to that that I hope when we look back on it that this will be a real changing point, that we can say, oh yes, that was what happened. There was this global pandemic. It was certainly, I feel, quite mismanaged. And yet out of it came adequate funding for the NHS, more attention to the effects of things like isolation, which were pre-existing problems for many people. This highlighted them. You know, I want those kind of examples to be something where, okay, we've refocused, we can change. And the personal reflection that we've described having, the government also has that personal reflection.
You know what, as a pundit, the one, I'm not going to say a silver lining because that sounds trite. The weird perk of this whole pandemic situation from my perspective is when you are somebody who comments on current affairs, there are this cabal of kind of dubiously funded representatives from think tanks who are registered charities, but they all have some kind of just terrible agenda, like they want to privatize the NHS or something like that. But they are mostly populated by neoliberals, so people who don't really believe in the concept of society. They think it's all about individualism and they believe that the world is a meritocracy. So that's what their belief system basically is. And you're always pitted against them. And, you know, they are really good at making themselves sound legitimate and convincing. So you end up having all of these really frustrating, pointless debates. And the great thing about the pandemic, she says, is that it really has unequivocally shown everyone how important things like the NHS and society and community are. And all of those dubiously funded think tank representatives have just disappeared, which is great. I hope they never come back.
And it's a really strange thing to see as a viewer with some insight of, you know, having been asked, I guess, to a lesser extent of yours to be a commentator on social issues, particularly debate shows where there is this pressure to have people at vastly different sides of political spectrum or whatever they're debating in general, as if that is the same as balance. Mm. To me, balance is perhaps being a lot closer to the middle of a debate and trying to weigh up both sides rather than two people shouting in what can feel like different languages. And that, I think, is where a lot of it gets over-intellectualized. And then you find someone like yourself having to debate something that I think to many of us is quite basic of. You're then having to debate that civil rights are human rights or that mental health is as important as physical health when it comes to healthcare. These should all be things we take for granted. But by giving a platform to people that are, in my view, anti mental health support or maybe anti-civil rights, for example, it legitimizes that these things are somehow not integral to our society and integral to equality and fairness that supposedly Britain is meant to be built on.
You're exactly right. That is exactly what's happened, that we've confused balance with always finding somebody who has the opposite opinion, no matter how common sense your opinion is. This is an old example because it no longer happens so much, but you have to find a person who disagrees that climate change is happening, even though 99% of the world's scientists acknowledge that it's a thing. And that should be taken as a baseline. And then we can discuss the more nuanced aspects of climate change and what can be done about it. No, we have to go back to basics and debate whether this is a thing. And there is a kind of, I think people find a lot of comfort in these neoliberal individualistic arguments. People like to think that whatever they have in their life, they got because they worked hard and they are 100% responsible for their own destiny.
Because you get that sometimes with mental health as well. And I wonder if that's how people wrap their head around it. It can be a real warning sign for us on who's maybe not appropriate to interview, for example, for the podcast. If someone is too focused on, oh, but I'm better now and everything's fine and I'm completely past it, that's certainly not been my experience of recovery. And I worry when people are really strident on that, of this kind of binary, I was ill, now I'm totally well, as if it's a broken arm, then, you know, that could be part of that internalized stigma, that they kept feeling the stigma, they got well as soon as they could, and I'm glad that they have progressed in their recovery. But I am quite cautious of the everything's fine, I'm cured idea. And I wonder if it comes from a similar place.
That's really interesting. And it probably does, you know. And the problem with thinking of it in that binary way is that when inevitably you encounter a challenge with your mental health, it then feels like a relapse, as opposed to being a bad day or a slight dip along the path of recovery or an opportunity to learn some new coping strategies. It becomes, I'm back to square one. And I see that a lot, particularly with people with experience of eating disorders and self-harm. They go through something which brings back those feelings and those urges. And it's almost that exhaustion of thinking, oh, I'm going to have to go through the entire recovery process again. And in fact, the way I see it, recovery is more like knitting. And sometimes you drop a stitch, but you've still knit the row, you know, and it doesn't undo all of the work that you've done so far.
Exactly. That's a great way of framing it. And yes, that's very much my concern, that if we get too focused on this binary idea, this idea that you're fixed, then the alternative means you're broken. If your symptoms come back, then you're broken and somehow you're kind of invalid for that. And that is, you know, that is massively a part of the stigma.
Hugely. And it also, I think, devalues the recovery experience, because I often say this, people who are either in therapy or they are learning how to sort of live alongside mental illness and function and feel well are the sanest people I know, because they have had to understand so much about how their brain works and how that affects their behavior and how they connect and communicate with other people and where they fit in the world. And that period of introspection has meant that they are generally the most self-aware, kind of kindest, most generous people that I know. And and I think that, you know, the recovery process is not, like you say, like a cast on a broken arm. It's so much more than that. And I almost feel like everybody should go through it, regardless of whether they have mental illness or not.
No, I really agree with that. And I think as part of that, there is so much banked knowledge you get. That whilst on one hand, the two mental illnesses I've had experience of, I probably am more vulnerable to going down a negative path with. And yes, there are certain unhealthy coping mechanisms as part of that, that I am potentially more open to reinitiating. At the same time, I also have tools that are really great for those exact things. And so I have this bank knowledge that would make, if we use the word relapse, would make a future relapse so much easier. And I would be so much more prepared for those symptoms or illnesses coming back with force.
Yeah, it's difficult, I think, sometimes to talk about this, because one of my key aims as a mental health campaigner is to universalize the mental health conversation and make people realize that mental health issues of any description are not just something that happens to a quarter of people because they're a bit weird and they're over there and nothing to do with us. But in fact, mental health issues encompass this huge spectrum of which we've all, to some extent, participated. And there are things that are not a mental illness or a diagnosable mental health issue, but they absolutely fall under the umbrella of mental health, like bereavement, for example, or loss or exam stress or body image insecurity. And everything obviously is on a spectrum, and things that your kind of common or garden mental health issues can develop into something more serious that requires treatment. But in saying those things, I don't want to diminish acute, severe mental illness and make it seem like, you know, we've all experienced that, because we definitely haven't. And I think the problem is we're just trying to shoehorn so much into one conversation. I mean, like, it's like if I said to you, I've had physical health issues, you'd be like, yeah, you're a human with a body. Obviously you have. But I could be talking about anything from like a runny nose to cancer, couldn't I? You know, and everything in between. And I think the next step is to be more specific when we're talking about mental health.
Yeah.
I don't know where that came from. Something you said triggered off that rant in me, sorry.
I mean, it might just be intrinsic, because that is very on brand for us, that okay. We want this conversation to be normalized. And that's why we campaign for mental health education, which is a, you know, whole other conversation we could have about schools getting back and the support we'd hope they receive. But just to loop back to what we started talking about of the schools going back in general, how you see the mental health implications for young people starting to go back to school?
I actually think we'll see more visible mental health issues as we're coming out of the crisis. And this is well documented, that when we're in crisis mode, we kind of go onto autopilot and we just do whatever we can to get through. And all the anxiety and trauma that we're feeling, our brains put them in a little box and go, right, we'll deal with this later when you're not so focused on getting through a crisis. And I think as children start to return to school, if perhaps they have been highly stressed or they've lost a loved one or, you know, whatever it is, all of those things are going to come to the surface once their environment becomes more normalized. And it's going to put even more pressure then on teachers to be able to meet mental health needs, because, of course, particularly for children, the services just aren't there. I mean, we spend so much more on adult services than we do on children's services, despite the average onset age for most mental illnesses being 14. So it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. So you have this situation where teachers who aren't qualified to do so are sort of trying to meet the mental health needs of children. And I think that that will become even more true in a few months or maybe a year's time.
Yeah, no, I think that's a perfectly understandable concern. And then in addition to that, you've got not only the adaptation that the kids are having to do and the fear that could be about going back to school, but also the fear of the parents and the mental health impact that could have.
Yeah, when I first started doing this job, I've been doing it since 2008, so 12 years now. Wow, I'm old. And when I first started doing this job, probably the commonest question I was asked by teenagers is, I've got this friend and I'm really worried about them and I don't know what to say. What can I do to help them? And sometimes I suspected that the friend was them and it was sort of easier to ask for advice in the third person. Sometimes I genuinely think that they didn't know how to offer support to a peer with mental health issues. But over the years, that started to change. And now I would say the most frequent question I'm asked by teenagers is, I've got an adult, parent, grandparent, aunt, uncle in my life who refuses to acknowledge that they're struggling with their mental health. And I can see it. And I think what that speaks to is a massive gap in emotional literacy. Most of the children and young people I speak to are hugely emotionally literate and they have much lower levels of stigma. That's part of the reason why, I don't know if you know, but I co-founded a campaign called Where's Your Head At that's all about workplace mental health. Because in schools, you've got a captive audience. You've got an hour of their time, which is such a gift because they have to be there. And yet with adults, there's kind of no such thing. So I thought I'm going to have to infiltrate workplaces somehow to try and kind of redress this balance.
No, I think that's brilliant. And we've actually mentioned it on the show before.
Oh, yay.
Yeah, I think it's really brilliant. And It's a great point. And that's something I get asked a lot from the other side when I'm campaigning for mental health education. People ask me, well, what about the parents? That as the school addresses more of these needs and the understanding that kids have is broadened, what about when they go back to parents that may be quite hostile towards talking about mental health? How do you redress that balance? And so I think it's got to be this two-tiered approach that the adults need extra support. I would never want anyone to demonize it. A lot of this comes from stigma that's rife in our society. I don't think parents are purposely trying to be misunderstanding when it comes to mental health of their children. I think a lot of it is lack of understanding and stigma. So I think it needs to be addressed for the adults. And also my hope would be that increased conversation of this from young people means they feel more confident bringing it up at home with parents that maybe wouldn't know how to. And so both sides can start more of these conversations.
Yeah, and that's what I always say to, I do parent talks in schools, and it's frustrating because the parents that show up are always those who need it least because it's voluntary. But they say, I just, you know, I don't understand what my child is talking about. And I say, look, this is an opportunity. So I'm like, just listen to what your child is telling you because they're probably right. And it's a weird thing because it's meant to be the other way around, isn't it? The adults are meant to mentor the children. But in certain areas, I think that it has to work in reverse because there's a new world emerging, a new society, a new understanding.
Yeah. And I think that's a really positive thing in so many ways. Just one final thing. If any parents are listening to this and they are incredibly fearful about sending their child back to school and maybe they're leaning more towards not doing that, what would you say to them?
I would absolutely support parents not sending their children back to school. I think parents need to support what teachers and the teaching unions are saying and vote with their feet. A recent study showed that you're definitely not alone if you feel that way. It's more than half of parents don't feel comfortable. They don't think it's safe to send their children back. And if you don't, if you keep your child home, then that is a really loud, unequivocal message to the government. And I think that would be very powerful.
For sure. And I would add to that, it's also worth noting that there hasn't been any penalty outlined. The government have been quite clear on this, that there won't be a penalty for parents making that decision. All right. So we'll wrap up there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.